virtually. You know, despite the best efforts of both India and Canada and the US, I think. Today I'm here, I'm going to talk to you some about driven dynamics in your phase transitions and how we can systemize universal content in it. This goes by the name of the Kibble-Zurich ramps, and we'll talk about ramps in your phase transitions both with and without an order parameter. Before I start, I'd really like to thank Gifu and all the administrators over at Perimeter for putting up with the multiple panicky emails I've sent them over the last week, without which this wouldn't be possible. So the school of my collaborators is, I've shown them as fishes below. So I'm the fish right below the title. And going from left to right, it's Fiona's at Oxford, Amir Erez is at Ben-Gurion, Vedika Kimani, Steve Gupser, and Shivaji Sondi, who's my advisor, are all at Princeton. Okay. So every good talk should start with a bang, and mine even starts with a big one. So the cosmologists in the 70s were very interested in understanding how the universe goes from the picture on the left to that on the right as it cools down and goes through multiple phase transitions. So Kibble specifically wanted to know, as the hot universe cooled down and went through a transition like, say, the Higgs, what is the consequence of the finite rate of this transition? And one conclusion he came to is that there will be remnant cosmic strings left behind in the symmetry broken phase, that is the Higgs phase, that might even be visible in the universe today. Unfortunately, the cosmological experiment is one that has been done for us by God, if you wish, and one that we had no control over. And Zurich pointed out that this should happen in many systems in the laboratory all the time. So the two pictures here are in liquid crystals. You see beautiful topological defects that form when you cool from the disordered phase to different ordered phases. The first question we should ask ourselves is, why should defects form at all? So let's pick our favorite critical point, the symmetry breaking transition from the paramagnet to the ferromagnet. So as you cool down the system, starting in the paramagnet to the ferromagnet at a finite rate, we expect that in the system, the symmetry should be broken as you arrive in the ferromagnet. Let's once again consider the simplest symmetry breaking transition we know, the one from the paramagnet to the ferromagnet as a function of temperature. So imagine cooling the system from the paramagnet to the ferromagnet at a finite rate. The finite rate is important, as we'll keep seeing over and over again. What we expect is, this being a symmetry breaking transition, that in the ferromagnet the symmetry is broken. However, the point is that different regions break the symmetry locally in different directions, defects must inevitably arise to accommodate this mismatch of symmetry breaking. So that's the reason that we expect defects to form as we cool through phase transition. So Zurich actually had a very nice argument that started to quantify what the density of these defects would be. And it's easy to see, so I'll go through it right now. So any critical point we know is accompanied by a critical slowing down. So there's a diverging correlation length here, xi, which diverges as delta to minus nu. Delta itself is the reduced temperature here. And an associated relaxation time, xi sub t, which diverges as xi to the power z. So as we go through this phase transition at a finite rate, if the evolution were to be adiabatic, this would be the expected response. Notice, however, that the closer we get to the critical point, the slower the response to the system, of the system. The time to the transition, on the other hand, is reducing as we approach the critical point. So we're tuning a knob at a finite rate, and we don't give the system enough time to respond as we get closer and closer to the critical point. And so there comes a time, which is this T sub K, known as the Kibble-Zurich time, when the system is unable to remain in equilibrium and keep up with the change because of this critical slowing down. And very simple arguments allow us to identify it to be what's in the box on the right. And so arguments like this led Zurich to predict a defect density that scales with the ramp time tau as shown above. So notice that it only depends on D, the spatial dimension of the system, mu and z, critical exponents. And so this is the Kibble-Zurich defect scaling law. And there have been multiple experiments in liquid crystal systems and superconductors, more recently in cold atom systems, which to varying degrees have confirmed or attempted to confirm this law. I think the experiments in the superconductors have been the most promising. Theoretically, there have been multiple extensions to port this over to the quantum critical phenomena world. What if it was a critical line instead of critical point? Could we look at some of the quantities like excess energy and so on? So there's a whole body of work, and I haven't done it enough justice with the citations here. However, today I want to tell you about our own contribution here, which is to really systemize the universal content here. You know, there's something clearly universal happening because the defect density itself only depended on critical exponents. So can we formalize this as a scaling limit? Can we go beyond just exponents and maybe extract scaling functions? And I will show you, yes, we can, and illustrate this with an example in the classical world with an order parameter. We'll then go on to doing Kibble-Zurich RAMs where there's no order parameter, specifically with topologically ordered systems. We'll think about Ising gauge theories and SU2 level 2 gauge theories. The 2 plus 1 transistor Ising model will be an important ingredient in what we say here, and will ultimately lead us to this idea of string net coarsening. So let's begin. So first, I want to take a step back from the temperature and the particular example of the magnet that I had. Just think more broadly of some kind of symmetry breaking transition as a function of delta. We're not restricted to go through the transition linearly. We have a whole bunch of possibilities. In fact, it could be nonlinear. So I've shown three topologies here. The one on the right that I call odd is akin to the linear ones we were talking about before. It's roughly speaking where one goes from phase one to phase two through the transition. The even one is the one where one starts in phase one, touches the critical point, and comes back to the same phase. And the negative one is where you asymptotically approach the critical point. The third one is actually, and it turns out they're a very interesting set of protocols, and unfortunately won't have time to talk about them today. But so given this generalized setup of a critical point and some general way of going through it, we can once again use Zurich's arguments to identify Tk and Lk. Tk is the time at which we fall out of equilibrium, and Lk is the correlation length at which we fall out of equilibrium. And so these two scales are more than just a measure of when non-adiabaticity kicks in. The fact that only the critical exponents, having to do just with the critical theory, play a role in determining the scales suggests to us that perhaps they control the entire universality of the dynamics near the critical point, and perhaps even a broader scaling theory. So in what limit do we expect these two scales to play the role of finite size scales in a scaling theory? That is the Kibble-Zurich scaling limit. So on the left, I've shown you two different ramps. The blue one is faster than the green. And we asked ourselves the questions, what happens as we slow down the ramp? Well, two things happen. One is that we fall out of equilibrium closer and closer to the critical point. By closer, I mean the value of delta, or the reduced temperature in the earlier case, is smaller. We're able to approach TC closer and closer as we increase the ramp time. This makes sense. This also means that the time and length scale, which we fall out of equilibrium, Lk and Tk, themselves diverge in this limit. So we're almost set. These are the usual ingredients for a scaling limit. If we measure length and time scales in units of Lk and Tk, we can then hope that microscopic differences between systems drop out, and that this limit will capture some universal dynamics. Hopefully I'll convince you that it captures all the universal dynamics in these systems. Okay. Having defined a scaling limit, we now ask, have to list the universal content that we can access in the scaling limit. And these are exponents and scaling functions. So a typical scaling function looks like the formula I have in the center of the slide, where on the left, you could fill in your favorite correlation function. you could fill in a thermodynamic quantity like energy or entropy. So here I have a function that's just a function of xt and tau, the ramp time. And in the limit of the slow ramp, we see that the quantity is only a function of these dimensionless ratios, x over lk and t over tk. Just a comment here about the defect density that is mostly alluded to in the literature, that the scaling law predicted by Zurich and investigated by other researchers since is actually a fixed positive t over tk in this scaling limit. I don't think this is appreciated as much, especially in the experiments that are done, within the scaling limit, one needs to, as one changes the ramp time, one measures the defects at different bear times, such that this ratio t over tk gets fixed. Okay, so we have a scaling limit. We know what universal content we can access in the scaling limit. We now ask ourselves, what are the pieces of data that fix this scaling content? And there's two pieces of information we need. One is the equilibrium critical theory itself, for which we need to know the symmetry of the order parameter, the spatial dimension, and actually we also need information about conserved quantities. More broadly, we need to know what the hydrodynamics is. So both exactly what happens at equilibrium and mildly out of equilibrium before we can say what happens to ramps. So when we add the layer of ramps on top, we also need to know exactly how we go through the critical point. And we don't need to know this in all detail. All we need to know is the leading behavior of delta, the parameter that controls the distance from the critical point. What is its leading behavior with time? So A here, the power, can be 1 if it's a linear protocol, or 2 if it's quadratic, and so on. So with these two pieces of information, we're now ready to ask ourselves the question, what do we learn taking the scaling limit and actually doing a ramp? So let's look at one quantity, the correlation length, something that we could access from a two-point function, say. And I've plotted here the response in equilibrium. We see that it diverges at the critical point. And now we want to do a linear ramp and ask what happens to the non-equilibrium correlation length. So as we said before, there's a regime where the evolution is indeed adiabatic. Nothing dramatic happens. The system follows along with the change up to this time minus t sub k. And then to zeroth order, we can assume that the system is actually basically frozen. Because recall, the way we determined what minus tk is was to say that that's when the system's response is much slower, or is getting slower than your rate of changing. So from minus tk to plus tk, this is the adiabatic response of the system is only getting ever slower, whereas the rate of change remains the same. And so pictorially, if I were to do this on the 2D Ising model with, say, Metropolis Dynamics, in the KZ critical region, I would see pictures that look like those in the left, some complicated out of equilibrium dynamics on the scale LK. Subsequently, this system emerges in the ferromagnet, having not picked a global direction to order in, but only having broken the symmetry locally. So the blue line then tells us that within each domain, so in the right-hand picture, these are the white and the black regions, the system is in fact back in equilibrium. However, there's a global length scale, LCO, at which it has not ordered, and that's the scale in which dynamics continues to take place. And the scale LCO keeps growing in time as bigger domains take over smaller ones, and the entire system attempts to order. Eventually, on some time scale set by the system size, some one particular direction will be picked and the system will be ordered. So can we actually see this in, say, a simple model? So let's look at the same function that we plotted as a cartoon in the previous slide, but now in an analytic calculation in the ON model in 3 dimensions. So this is actually for a classical ON model in the large N limit, where we have purely relaxational dynamics. So there are no conserved quantities. There's just the only slow mode is the order parameter. So I've written what the scaling form would be in this limit. We see that it's only a function of the dimensionless ratio t over tk, which I've plotted on the x-axis. So in dashed lines is the equilibrium response, and in solid line is what actually happens when doing a linear ramp. So we see that we recover on the left-hand side of this plot the adiabatic limit when the system is keeping up with the change. And the right-hand side, we indeed recover this coarsening limit. You see that length scale, this bigger length scale of the system LCO is actually growing as square root of t. This can be independently, this scale can actually be independently obtained by doing sudden quench studies in the same system. And so that's an independent check on ramps that that the same scale is obtained for coarsening. Okay. Finally, there's a nice way to collect this information, the scaling limit, in a picture that is probably very familiar to many people in the audience. So I've plotted here the quantum critical span, as it's called. So delta is a parameter that tunes you through a quantum critical transition, you say the ferromagnet to the paramagnet. And as a function of temperature, this critical span emerges. There may or may not be a finite temperature transition. So solid lines may be crossover or lines are actual critical lines. And by the quantum classical mapping, we treat the temperature direction as a finite imaginary time direction and write down scaling forms like the one I've written below for some quantity g. So in the same spirit, we could actually draw the picture for the Kibble-Zirk ramps that we've been talking about. So the x-axis remains the same, but the y-axis has now been replaced by this parameter 1 over tk. So we actually imagine for every given ramp, what we're doing is actually just traversing this curve parallel to the x-axis. So 1 over tk is fixed for a given ramp. We just go across, and in the scaling limit, 1 over tk is going to 0, much like on the left in the scaling limit, temperature is going to 0. And we see that the three regimes on the left, the corresponding three regimes here, are the adiabatic, Kibble-Zirk critical, and the coarsening regimes that we just talked about in the previous slide. The scaling forms on the left and the right then directly just, it's literally I replace t, capital T, by 1 over tk, and I get the scaling forms on the right. Okay. I don't know if I should be asking for questions as we go along, or I should wait till the very end.
Other questions? So I actually have one. Can you repeat how you could, what's the street of replacing the temperature with 1 over tk?
Okay, yeah. So basically what we're doing is I wrote down a scaling theory in which TK and LK played the role of finite size, basically. And so another place where we know this happens is in the role played by temperature near a quantum critical point. It acts like a finite size direction of size 1 over T, and in the limit of the temperature going to 0, this direction becomes very, very long and then reoccurs zero temperature. So similarly, the scaling limit that we're taking here is the limit of this finite size 1 over tk going to 0. As we take the ramp time to infinity, 1 over tk goes to 0, and we're actually kind of approaching the x-axis here, and the three regimes that I showed you are universal only in the limit of hitting the x-axis. Did that clarify?
Okay, thanks.
Should I keep going then?
Yes, please.
Okay. I hope I'm not going too quickly, but so I hope I convinced you there is a scaling framework and a way to think about the dynamics of ramps near critical points in a way that does not depend on microscopics, and it's the same for a given pairing of a critical point and how one goes through the ramp. But you notice that the initial set of arguments I gave about how one thinks about this relies heavily on this idea of broken symmetry, whereas on generalizing it and thinking about a scaling framework, we're led to believe that perhaps that's not all that important. So that's the approach I'm going to take to the second half of the talk, where I try to do the Kibble-Zirk ramps, but now without an order parameter, where the scaling theory should still apply. So here I'll start off by reminding you about the Eisengage theory and its phase diagram, and what where the 2+1 detransitizing model plays a role in this phase diagram, and how this naturally leads us to this idea of string neck coarsening, and then we'll talk about generalizations to more complicated topological orders. Okay, so the pure Ising gauge theory, let's consider it on the on the square lattice. So our degrees of freedom live on links. They're the sigmas, and they're the gauge fields, they're spin a half. The x base is what we call the electric field basis. So whenever sigma x is -1, we draw a pink line. Like any gauge theory, we have a Gauss law in this Hilbert space, whereby we demand that at every vertex, the number of electric field lengths coming in is even. So it's a Gauss law, but mod 2 because we're in Ising gauge theory. So this tells us that the only allowed physical configurations in our gauge theory must form loops. Okay, so we've set up the Hilbert space in the electric field basis, and we then recognize that the conjugate basis has the magnetic excitations, here the vortices. So BP here measures the flux piercing a plaquette as the product of sigma z over a plaquette. If it's -1, we say there's a vortex there. It's +1, there's no vortex there. The Hamiltonian is then the familiar B square plus E square. The first term in this Hamiltonian penalizes vortices on every plaquette. That looks like B square. And the second term penalizes electric field, and that looks like E square. So we've now set up a simple gauge theory in the Ising language, and we would like to know what the phase diagram is. So we plot it against this dimensionless parameter gamma over k. The first thing we do is make contact with something that we know very well, which is the toric code. The toric code point is when gamma is 0, and Hamiltonian is just this minus k sum over p, b sub p. So those of you very familiar with the toric code, you might be a little bit alarmed because you might wonder where the star term is. And the star term is actually hidden in the fact that we impose a Gauss law constraint on this Hilbert space. So the star term can never be violated within this Hilbert space. So the point where gamma is 0 is exactly the toric code point where this excitation spectrum has no electric charges. Looking over to the other side at very, very large gamma, we see that it's actually a trivial product state of all the spins just pointing along the x direction. So let's characterize these phases a bit more. One way to think about the toric code phase is that it's where the string tension parameterized by gamma is very, very small. So all the pictures that I will draw up to for a few more slides will be in the x basis. So it'll always be in red, I hope. And you should think of them as configurations in the x basis. So the string tension being small means that the arbitrarily long strings of the electric flux are fine. And the wave function is a superposition of a large number of them. It's exactly the toric code point. It's an equal superposition of all of them. Moving away from it, there would be some bias, but that's the broad feature of the phase. On the other side, the string tension is very, very big. Consequently, a wave function is very few of them, and they will be very, very small. Further, we know that the toric code phase is the topologically ordered phase, and the one on the right being connected trivially to the product state of spins all along the aligned in the x direction is the trivial phase. Just to make contact with more familiar gauge theory terms, the phase in the topologically ordered phase is the deconfined phase. So if we thought about like test quarks, here test electric charges, in the toric code phase, they're deconfined. We can take them away to infinity, whereas in the trivial phase, they're confined. Okay. So we now want to think about what happens as we start our ramp in the deconfined phase, go through the critical point, and emerge in the confined phase. Now, as such, this would be a hard problem because, as we said, there's no order parameter. We wouldn't know where to start, how to start approaching this problem if we didn't have duality to our aid in this specific case. So it turns out that the 2+1D Ising gauge theory maps exactly onto the 2+1D transitional Ising model. So the degrees of freedom for the 2 plus 1 transistor-scale-izing model live on the sites of the dual lattice. So they're the taus that you see on the left. And BP, the term that measures the flux through plaquette, goes to tau x. And the term that penalizes the electric field goes to tau z in the transistor-scale-izing model. This is nice because this actually, we up to important issues regarding boundary conditions that we can take care of. It directly maps, the deconfined phase maps to the paramagnetic phase of the 2 plus 1 transistorizing model, the confined phase maps to the ferromagnet. So these electric flux lines that we drew in the previous slide then have the direct interpretation as being domain walled in this 2 plus 1 transistorizing model. Further, this identifies the transition between the two phases as being in the 3D Ising class. So this is progress. We've now mapped up to boundary condition issues. We've mapped our problem of our Kibble-Zurich problem involving no order parameter to one where it seems to involve an order parameter. So the story I told you in the first half of the talk should go through. However, the 2 plus 1 prior to our work, not much is known about the 2 plus 1 transistorizing model and ramps in it itself. So I'm going to tell you some about exactly what happens there. It turns out that the non-integrability of the problem and its quantum nature makes the scaling functions a bit delicate and the information in them not so obvious as what it presented before. So let's take a slight detour and talk about what the Kibble-Zurich, what the scaling theory would tell us about ramps in the 2 plus 1D transistorizing model. So this is a picture we just saw. Once again, I plotted the non-equilibrium correlation length on the y-axis versus time. We'd identified two regimes, the adiabatic regime, the Kibble-Zurich critical regime, which we can once again do for this quantum critical point. Because if at the quantum critical point here at t is equal to zero, we know that a many-body gap closes. And so surely we're not so surprised that that on going past it, we're forced to create some excitations in the system. And these are the defect densities. This is the defect density we talked about in the ordered phase. The question really is what happens after that. And here I want to emphasize that this, our quantum 2 plus 1D transistor-Ising model, is very, very different from the classical dissipative system in which I previously presented this picture coarsening to you. So let me just point out what a few of those differences are. First is that our quantum magnet is actually a driven isolated system. So although we're changing a parameter here, k over gamma, to tune it we're tuning it in the Hamiltonian to drive the system from the paramagnetic to the ferromagnetic phase. If I were to actually plot what the excess energy density above the instantaneous ground state is, right? So if it was adiabatic, it would just be zero. However, because I'm doing work on the system, it actually increases in time. So but when I arrive in the ferromagnet, it's not zero. So this then hints to us that it's not merely the zero temperature phase diagram that we should think about, you know, what are the phases in that? But we should also consider what the finite temperature phase diagram is. In other words, the question we should ask ourselves is, suppose we stop the ramp at some time and just waited an infinite amount of time such that the excess energy density in the system at the time we stop is allowed to thermalize, in what phase does the system end up? Right? So the way I've drawn the arrow, you actually see that the energy, the work we do on the system is such that the system always stays within the finite temperature ordered phase. And so this is a very general result. Unfortunately, won't be able to go through how we arrived at it with you, but I'm happy to tell anyone who's interested. But what we can always prove is that if there is a finite temperature ordered phase, which there is in the 2 plus 1 transistor-Ising model, then the late time evolution is such that the excess energy density corresponds to being in the finite temperature order phase. Okay, so That's good. That suggests that at least there's any long time limit that looks like coarsening can happen because the system hasn't broken the symmetry on the longest length scales, but because its evolution is still in the finite temperature ordered phase, it's going to try to establish this long range order. But there remains a question, which is how can it set up this long range order in the finite temperature ordered phase? So in the classical dissipative system, the way this works is that bigger domains, so say you thought about spin ups and spin downs, if there's a spin up domain surrounding a spin down one, it just eats it up. And similarly, a bigger one surrounding the up one would eat that one up, and so on. This is the process of domain growth, which looks like coarsening to us when the system is classical and dissipative. However, that's not what we have here. It's certainly not dissipative. Energy is conserved. So how does the process of domain growth work when energy is conserved? It turns out that the way this happens is actually that that their domains that grow send actually generate heat that's sent into the interior of them. This is to say that it's an entropically driven process at fixed energy. This can already be demonstrated within a classical system that's isolated and conserves energy. However, our system is quantum, and so we may have other effects about coherence that worry us. So here one has to do a more detailed analysis of scattering processes that I won't be able to get into right now. And we've also been investigating this within this large-n quantum model to see that it works out. But the bottom line is that although it's delicate, the three regimes that we talked about for classical systems, adiabatic, stable-dirac critical, and coarsening, can be argued to be the same three regimes for the quantum 2+1D transistorizing model. Okay, so we're now ready to take what we know about the 2+1D transistorizing model and its scaling functions and translate what that means for the pure gauge theory that's of interest to us. So this is the phase diagram for the pure gauge theory again. We're going from the deconfined to the confined phase. That's our pink arrow. So in the past, as t over tk tends to minus infinity, our wave function looks like something close to the ground state at the toroid code point, the superposition of very long loops in the electric flux spaces. As we approach the critical point at t order tk, we know that the average size of the smallest loop is set by LK, the longer loop spaces in the system, but the smallest electric flux loops have disappeared. However, the system now freezes out and arrives in the confined phase with having loops of very, very long length. And these now start to coarsen, much like the domain walls do in the 2+1D transistorizing model, and their average size at time t is set by LCO. LCO is growing in time. So here's the promised strain net coarsening. It's not these, so it's the duality to the 2+1D transistorizing model here allows us to establish what we think is a broader phenomenon of the strain nets that underlie the topological deconfined phase that we start with, their coarsening process in the confined trivial phase. Okay, so the wave function, though, has, as always, has too much information. So we would like to ask questions of specific observables to see what the signatures of this coarsening process is and more broadly what the scaling functions look like. So let's look at two of them. This one is the Wilson loop. The Wilson loop is defined to be, it measures the flux within a curve. So I plotted the blue curve on the left is of size R. And the Wilson loop measures the flux piercing the interior of this curve. And it has a scaling form written at the top of the slide. The Wilson loop itself, without dynamic matter, probes confinement. It has two kinds of behavior depending on the phase. In the deconfined phase, it has a perimeter law. It goes like e to the minus r. Whereas in the confined phase, it goes as e to the minus r squared. So what we see is in the infinite past, when the system is in fact in the deconfined phase and adiabatic, indeed it obeys a perimeter law as a function of r over lk. So everything here is in scale units. I should emphasize that I'm plotting scaling functions. Whereas for t over tk much, much bigger than 1, when we claim that the system exhibits the string net coarsening, we actually see that there should be a crossover from a behavior that looks like confinement at short distances, so an area law, to something that's actually perimeter at long distances. And so the scale that sets this crossover is in fact LC over LK. LCO is this recurring scale you see that is supposed to be growing in time, and it grows in time with some exponent theta, which would depend on. Yeah, sorry. Yes, there should be braces around it. It should be an expectation value. I think I haven't written. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, this is a mistake. I meant to say that the there should be an expectation value surrounding the product over. Yeah. Okay, great. So we indeed see that there is a crossover from area law-like behavior to perimeter law-like behavior at late times, and this scale is set by this LCO. Let's look at a second observable, which is the vortex pair creation observable. So we haven't talked about vortices for a while. Recall that a vortex was defined to be to live on the dual lattice. It's when the VP on a blackhead is -1. It's shown by these blue spheres on the picture on the right. So it turns out that one can actually understand the deconfinement-confinement transition as a vortex condensation transition. Specifically, what we mean by this is that the creation operator for a vortex at infinity and a vortex somewhere in the system develops an expectation value. So there's this long string-like operator that creates two vortices. And so when we take S prime off to infinity, keeping S fixed, if we were in equilibrium in the confined phase, this would have an expectation value. So we can ask ourselves, how does this expectation of this operator behave in time as we do this ramp? So once again, in the deconfined phase, we see that it doesn't do anything spectacular. It has an exponential vk to zero at long distances, as it's not that phase is uncondensed. However, at long positive times, t hat much, much bigger than 1, or t over t much, much bigger than tk, once again, we see this interesting crossover behavior from something that appears to approach a constant, you know, up to some scale, which t hat to the theta, that's fixed by this coarsening scale, but it then goes off to zero. And so this is once again indicative of the fact that on scales longer than t hat to the theta, these strings haven't gone away. We have long strings in the sigmatic spaces, and that causes the condensate to be disordered. This is reflected now in this WM parameter. Okay. I have kind of two final comments about other things we could learn in this run, other quantities we could look at. So although the topological nature of the deconfined phase has kind of subtly played a role in everything I've said before, because the existence of the string nets themselves, imply that the phase is topological. Exists in the condensate of string nets imply the phase is topological. There's kind of a more explicit signature we could talk about with respect to this, the topological degeneracy. So recall that in the deconfined phase, we have the degeneracy of the ground state manifold is set by the genus. So I've assumed that the system is on a torus here. So it's fourfold degenerate. And at finite size, the splitting is exponentially small in system size. In the confined phase, on the other hand, the splitting is actually order L, depends on the linear size of system, and the ground state is unique. So is there a signature of this behavior in the energy time-dependent energy measured in a ramp from the deconfined to confined phase? And indeed, there is. So all the physics that we've been discussing so far about defects and having long strings and so on is an energy density above the ground state. And so this appears at order L square if I just look at the total energy, right? So what this picture on top tells us is that there's a sub-leading universal piece as well at order L. And what this depends on is the initial topological sector we start the ramp in. So whether we start in you know, a one with no strings wrapping around either of the holes or one of them, etc. So depending on the particular topological sector we start our ramp in, we may or may not have an order L piece at late positive times when the system is evolving in the confined phase. But nevertheless, the order L term, along with the order L square term, will be universal and is indicative of this topological degeneracy. Okay. There's a second generalization, which is to ask ourselves, what happens if we turn on a tiny amount of coupling to matter? So everything we've talked about so far has been in the pure gauge theory, and there's been absolutely no matter, and the coupling to a QH has been set to zero. Whereas what we do know from equilibrium studies is that if we turn a little bit of matter gauge coupling, it's actually an irrelevant perturbation to the critical point. So the critical point goes into critical line and it remains in the 3D Ising universality class. So we're now ready to ask the question, well, what happens as we ramp through this transition slightly above the x-axis? Well, although it's irrelevant to the equilibrium theory, it's important for the dynamics. Particularly what happens is it gives rise to a density of matter excitations at late times that's exponentially small in LK, this Kibble-Zurich length. This actually means that coarsening stops, because recall coarsening is this idea that the long strings of electric flux, that there are arbitrary long strings off them, and the short and they keep their size keeps increasing in time. However, if there is a density of charge, these electric flux lines can end at the charge, and coarsening surely stops whenever the strings hit charge. The key observation here is that the scale at which this charge appears is much, much bigger than LK. In fact, it's exponentially bigger than LK. So in the scaling limit itself, where we measure all lengths and units of the Kibble length, okay, we would never see this phenomenon of matter. Actually, we wouldn't see matter at all, and therefore we would never see coarsening stop. However, we do know that the actual long time limit in this ramp is different from what we see in the scaling limit. So this is the hallmark of a dangerously irrelevant perturbation to the dynamics. So the message here is that an irrelevant operator to the statics can act as a dangerously irrelevant operator to the dynamics, and here this is a nice example of it. And we shouldn't perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that the scaling limit does not capture the physics of this irrelevant operator, because after all we conjectured that a given critical point and the particular way we go through it is all we need to know to fix the entire universal content. This in that statement is hiding the fact that irrelevant perturbations play no role in the scaling, Kibble-Zurich scaling limit. Okay. Finally, for those in the audience who the entire phase diagram, there's this these kind of arguments that let us go a little bit away from the pure gauge line, actually tell us what happens everywhere on this phase diagram. So there's, as we turn up the matter gauge coupling, there's an entire topologically ordered phase. The toroidal phase persists up to finite coupling. And for all ramps that start in the topologically ordered phase and go to the trivial one, scaling functions are exactly as we've discussed. Are there any questions, or should I keep going? I have a feeling I'm going very quickly.
What you did here was to utilize the hardcore constraint of just star terms. Is that the phase diagram of the toroidal?
And this is the phase diagram of the generalized toroidal. So I both really.
So initially you had a Hamiltonian that only depended on there were two terms in the Hamiltonian.
That's right.
And now you have three terms, I guess.
No, I have four terms.
Four.
Because I both turn on a matter gauge coupling. And I can have a field for
matter
the
gauge
creation of that.
So suddenly you have matter on this vertices of the model? Is that
I turn on a term that is a transverse field for the matter, so tau x.
Okay, so that's the usual generalization of the model. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Sorry, just I can say a few more words about that because I didn't write down the Hamiltonian just because I want to tell you it works. The two terms that I add are I add a term that's tau z sigma z tau z. Taus are now the matter degrees of freedom that live on vertices, and what they do, so their basic purpose is that they have to suck in all the electric flux that comes in, the violations of the star term. And so the tau z sigma z tau z term allows the charge from electric flux to hop, and I turn on another term, which is gamma m tau x. So the x-axis is the ratio of the two, j over gamma m. But this is identical to the generalized toroid code where we have BP, AS, sigma z and sigma x, two transverse fields. This is the same phase diagram. All right. I finally want to tell you a little bit about how one could generalize these ideas to non-abelian topological orders, specifically how the loops of electric flux that we saw will actually become string nets, and how we need not be restricted merely to transitions from topologically ordered phases to trivial ones, but could generalize to transitions that just reduce topological order, like from a non-abelian phase to an abelian phase. So I'll just briefly sketch this in the perturbed Levenman model that realizes the, SU2 level 2 cross SU2 level 2 bar topological order. This is the doubled version of the P plus IP superconductor. It's a chiral. We're now on a honeycomb lattice. And previously we had two flavors of the electric flux, plus one and minus one. Now we have three, zero, one half, and one. Our Gauss law itself is a little bit more complicated, but it basically follows the fusion rules for these spins in SU2 level 2. And morally speaking, the Hamiltonian that we write down is very similar to the one we wrote before. It has a B square term and an E square term. The B square term is quite complicated and involves kind of the six spins in a plaquette and the six spins on links emerging from that plaquette, and it's not very illuminating to write down for our purposes, so I've written it down here, but this can be done and was indeed done by Levin and Wen a few years ago. And by adding suitable terms, which is actually the E square term in the pure gauge theory, one can drive a transition much like we did in the Ising gauge theory from the deconfined phase to the confined phase. However, the topological orders in both these phases are different from what we had before. Specifically, where previously we had the deconfined phase was in the toricoid phase, now the topological order is this SU2 level 2 cross SU2 level 2 bar. However, we can make an identification that maps it onto the problem that we just looked at if we only looked at the loops of one hat label. So that's what I plotted as red in the figure. The fusion rules themselves allow for the blue labels to start and end on these loops or form their own loops. But if we restrict our attention to the red loops, we see that indeed the transition, this more complicated system, can be mapped onto the Ising-Gage, the transition that we just discussed in the Ising-Gage theory, in which the one-half nets coarsen. And the particular vortex that condenses involves this label 1, the 1 cross 1 bar 1. However, in this, although the scaling functions and all the physics we discussed before transfers to this problem, the topological orders on either side themselves are different. Perhaps this is most apparent by looking at the phase that we previously called the polarized one, the one where gamma is very, very big. And this is the trivial phase where all the spins are pointing in the x direction. Now this is actually the toric code phase for the blue labels. So we go from a non-abelian phase on the left to an abelian phase on the right, as opposed to an abelian phase on the left to a trivial one on the right. So the message here is that despite the topological orders being different, despite there being multiple string nets, we can systematically study the coarsening of one particular string net and therefore investigate transition between different topological orders. So more broadly, we believe that this idea that on going between one kind of ordered phase to another must always exhibit the coarsening of the string nets that get confined as we go through the transition. Okay, so let me summarize. I apologize if that was all very quick. So I started out by establishing a Kibble-Zurich scaling framework, tried to convince you that there is a limit of slow ramps that one could take in which there was a meaningful scaling limit, and scaling functions that one could discuss that are universal for a given pair of critical point and the way we cross the ramp. We applied this to symmetry breaking transitions and then to transitions in which topological order is reduced. I tried to show you that there is a phenomenon called coarsening that happens at late times in a quantum system. This has previously been studied only for classical dissipative systems. But we saw that there are many arguments we can make that this should arise in the 2 plus 1 e-tensilizing model, in the large N model, and more broadly in these models with no order parameter in the form of string net coarsening. I just want to flag that the scaling framework itself leads to many different ideas and many different ways to go out from there. So one particular, a few things we've explored are these ideas of hysteresis, where instead of going, interchanging a parameter that does not explicitly break the symmetry, one can tune something like the field in the 2D Ising model. Instead of doing the temperature, we tune the field. Then one actually predicts that there are universal hysteresis loops in, say, the magnetization response. And this is particularly nice because it seems that there can be interesting experiments that seem feasible here that would go beyond the defect density kind of experiments proposed for ramps in the temperature direction. An interesting protocol that I did not have time to discuss today was this asymptotic approach to the critical point. In the scaling theory, even at the level of the Gaussian field theory, we have anomalous dimensions that emerge. And finally, this gauge gravity duality, or the ADS CFT correspondence that's been on everyone's to-do list, it sounds like, recently. It might be a nice tool to explore a lot of this dynamics, because there's a picture, if there's a holographic dictionary for things that happen on a boundary in bulk, And something we've just been playing around with is to see what doing ramps on in interacting boundary theory looks like from the view of the bulk. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. And just to clarify, the background here is supposed to be a string net coarsening. Thank you.
Any questions? Anushya, I have two questions. One is classical, one is quantum.
Okay.
In real experiments involving coarsening, for example, if you take two superconductors, go from superconductor to normal state, or if you take a ferromagnet and heat it in various ramp conditions, defects play a very important role in the coarsening dynamics. For example, domain walls can be very easily pinned if you have some vacancies. Mm-hmm. So it changed the whole picture of simple critical slowing down. In the sense it widened the region of slowing down. So have you studied or have you thought about that problem? That is, this whole issue in the presence of defects, which seems to be...
So you mean in the presence of disorder, some background?
Was my question clear?
I think with you, are you asking me what happens to a lot of this coarsening physics when there's disorder in the background?
That's right, yeah.
That's a very interesting question, and I think it's a hard question. We've thought about generalizing this framework to disorder, but it's what's not clear to us, and as far as I know, I think that no one knows yet, is how important all these orders of limits are. It's like you can generalize some notion of this replica. So you can do replicas and you can write down some nonlinear sigma model for like for this problem with dynamics in the classical case. It's just not clear if any scaling limit you take is meaningful for the whole ensemble with disorder. And I think it's because of issues that you point out, that each particular disordered configuration has some specific late time dynamics, which is widely different from sample to sample. So everything I've said, I think, is only.
Okay. Yeah. My second question is about the quantum case. Mm-hmm. So suppose you start with a pure quantum many-body state and you ramp. Then it amounts to adding excitations to the system.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, you are very quickly going to some classical situation. You know, from a very pure state, you are very quickly, even locally, going into some kind of impure state. Very crudely. So what I mean is, to characterize this particular time-dependent phenomena, maybe one has to go beyond Wilson loop and correlation function that you consider. For example, things like entanglement, topological entanglement. How do they? My question is, how is the system losing its quantumness?
This whole picture I presented about coarsening and so on is one way it's losing its quantumness. Because basically, if you thought about, if you really took those pictures of string net coarsening seriously, I'm literally saying, for each configuration of electric field, roughly speaking, you can think of it behaving almost classically, like it's expanding up to this caveat of energy conservation. It's almost just behaving like a classical system that's exhibiting this coarsening. So I think in some sense in the picture I've shown, and we spent some time justifying this, kind of inherently assumes that there's some classicality. And we're not so worried that, in fact, it's a quantum superposition. There can be interference effects between, you know, different configurations that are coarsening this. And I think justification for that is in the spirit of what you said, that matrix elements connecting all these widely different configurations become very small as you keep going deeper into the face. You almost, the approximation where you treat them as classical extended objects with some a gas of local excitations that's just scattering off each other. This seems to be a good way to think about it. What this has to do with entanglement itself is it's something that I roughly based on what we know the excited states of the both in the toric chord phase diagram and phase and in the confined phase do, we can predict what we think something like the topological entanglement entropy would be. But what we need to do at this point is probably do some, figure out some way to do numerics to actually check these.
Thank you.
Are there more questions? Okay, so I have a question. It's about methodology. So at some level, if I understood this correctly, for the first model, for the toric chord of Z2 gauge theory, you consider, well, you use the duality to the two plus y rising model.
That's right.
And then, how did you solve that, or how did you learn about what happens in the Ising model?
It's hard in that it's the, I don't know, the arguments we have there are a combination of what we can semi-analytically do in the large n limit. So we can actually study the ON model as n tends to infinity in the quantum problem. And there we've seen all the features that I've described to you that in the 2 plus 1 transistorizing model take place. A few things to worry about from, in you know, extrapolating n tends to infinity back to n is equal to 1 is that the n tends to infinity limit is, the model is not, it has a strange degree of integrability that does not make its behavior completely generic. And but most of our arguments, that most of what I presented to you is what happens is what we know from calculations only as in the limit of n going to infinity.
Okay, and then for the string n model, so you just argued that something similar may be happening, but involving the new degrees of freedom, and of course you go from topological phase to topological phase. But is there, so you discussed that case, but is there any, what is the source of your result in that? Is it just reasoning, or is there something else?
Is it just, could you repeat?
So in the second example that you had,
right.
Did you just argue what you think may be happening, or did you use some established results, or did you derive some results?
So the two chief results are there's actually an exact mapping within a particular low energy Hilbert space to the in that second example back to the Ising gauge theory. So if you restrict yourself to a part of the Hilbert space, there's an exact mapping that in equilibrium that maps the spectrum at each point in the, along that line to the Ising gauge theory. So what we did was to show that the same mapping goes through even for the dynamics. You can show analytically. The main kind of ingredients there were that we had to show that the presence of the extra labels did not change the values of say, any physical quantities that we're interested in, and that gapped modes, which could involve creating actually non-abelian excitations, also do not affect what we see in the scaling limit.
Okay, thanks a lot. Any other questions? All right, if there are no more questions, then let's stop here.